You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
We try to restore the sense of mystery to the human psyche. In other words, what we're really trying to get our readers to consider is that there are deep, deep parts of you that you're not conscious of, that may seem like problems, but they're actually resources that you've never tapped into before. Once you can forge a relationship with it, it becomes this incredible resource that allows you to do things that you never thought you could do before. And what the tools are for is to bring up that force that you've never had access to.
I think a lot of the visualizations you recommend are very powerful. They're around what I think is a very simple idea, which is distancing yourself from these pains and these struggles, from who you really are.
Exactly.
Like, you start off the book talking about how we can best bring to life the living force that's inside of us. I love it because it makes me think of the Force in Star Wars, and it makes me think of, oh, if I apply these tools, there's infinite power at my disposal. And what would you say are the techniques that you like the best that really does let you feel the Force? Very happy to have with me today on the podcast, Barry Michaels. We're talking about your book, Coming Alive, Four Tools to Defeat Your Inner Enemy, Ignite Creative Expression, and Unleash Your Soul's Potential, which is an excellent book. I've already applied several of, you discussed these four tools. I've already applied all of them, and it's great. But I first read you in your first book, or your earlier book, The Tools, Five Tools to Help You Find Courage, Creativity, and Willpower, and Inspire You to Live Life in Forward Motion, which came out in 2012. I was telling you earlier, I used that book very, very specifically. I've always been a public speaker for like the past 20 years, but I had to give this one talk that terrified me, and for whatever reason, for a variety of reasons, and your tool in The Tools called The Shadow. I think there was another name for it. But
it's called Inner Authority.
Inner Authority, but what you talk about
is
how you split apart your shadow self, the self that has all these fears, and then you show very much compassion and love towards the shadow, and then it's no longer your enemy, it's kind of your partner if you have to give a talk, for instance, or go into a scary situation. And I find that these, you know, people could laugh at these visualization techniques, but I find that they're very useful. They give kind of this inner relaxation that are very targeted for specific situations.
Yeah, I think that people can laugh at it sometimes because they're only looking at it as a visualization. And really, we try to restore the sense of mystery to the human psyche. In other words, what we're really trying to get our readers to consider is that there are deep, deep parts of you that you're not conscious of. That's why they call it the unconscious, that may seem like problems, but they're actually resources that you've never tapped into before. And this is what I love about the idea of the shadow, is it's something you feel generally, you feel a little ashamed or guilty about your shadow. But once you can forge a relationship with it, it becomes this incredible resource that allows you to do things that you never thought you could do before.
Well, I think there's probably a couple of reasons, and correct me if I'm wrong. One is, obviously, self-awareness is very important. Like, why are we doing the things we're doing? What things from our past might trigger anxiety in the present that then makes us make bad decisions for the future. But I think also, I might say to myself, oh, I'm feeling really scared about giving this talk. I kind of want to run away. But when you're forced to kind of congeal all these fears into one place, it really forces you to think, well, what are these fears? Why am I feeling these fears? So, and you talk about this in Coming Alive, this idea of when things are going wrong, label as much as possible what's happening. And it's this very meditative practice of, okay, I'm feeling anxiety. I probably shouldn't make a decision right now, or I should be careful. I'm not making bad decisions. So even just labeling what your emotional state is at any given point helps you to live a more functional and effective life, I think.
Absolutely. It's enormously helpful. The moment, I mean, I'm, by the way, the opposite of you. I'm terrified of public speaking. I was only forced into it, frankly, when The Tools became a New York Times bestseller and we had to go on the radio, on Charlie Rose, on Dr. Oz, et cetera, et cetera. And labeling was incredibly helpful because the moment I labeled my anxiety, which really anxiety isn't the right word, it was more like, get me out of here, I'd rather die than do this, you know, right. Kind of thing. The moment you label it, it doesn't necessarily go away, but it's not you. You are the one who's doing the labeling. So it pushes it away from you just enough for you to have a little bit of distance and a little bit more sanguine attitude. It just gives you a little breathing room to say, it's okay, I am scared. There is a part of me that's terrified, but I can still proceed, you know, kind of thing. In a way, it has to do with a deeper concept about the human psyche, which is we are never just one thing. When you're really enraged, you're never just that rage. When you can label the rage, there's a part of you that's separate from the rage that's labeling it. When you're terrified, if you can label the terror, then there's a part of you that's not in the terror.
Well, it's interesting because I want to get into that very concept of like when you were just saying that you put up your hand, you extended your arm and put up your hand as if there's a distance between, for instance, these fears or these anxieties and who you really are. And I think a lot of the visualizations are all about that you recommend in both The Tools and Coming Alive are very powerful, but they kind of are around what I think is a very simple idea, which is distancing yourself from these pains and these struggles from who you really are.
Exactly.
And then it's so you know, understanding that, it's almost like, I mean, I think The Tools are very good because in both The Tools and Coming Alive, because they kind of are going after one, you know, each one is going after a different type of problem, but they're still all around this idea that you can also just visualize, oh, the world's a big place, time's, you know, the universe is 14 billion years old. This is not that important. I'm going to distance myself from this minor worry about whether my daughter is speaking to me or not or whatever.
Exactly. So you're bringing up another point now, which is that what The Tools do is they try to help you root yourself in a stream of time. Part of what powerful emotions do is they create the impression that what's happening now is of absolute life and death paramount importance, whereas we know that tomorrow you probably won't feel that way about.
It's so true. Like so many times, I mean, this is just a common situation, but so many times, let's say it's Friday afternoon and a boss or someone who has some power over you say, you know, leaves a message at 4:59 p.m. James, I think we better have a talk. Call me when you can. And of course, then you call 5:10 p.m. on a Friday, out of the office till Monday. And you're thinking, oh my God, how am I going to survive till Monday? Like, I'm just going to have anxiety nonstop until Monday. That's like a regular occurrence, but there's ways to deal with it.
Absolutely. Can I tell you a personal story?
Sure, of course.
This is sort of ridiculously personal, but my mother was just an extraordinarily difficult woman. You know, she was what in psychiatry they would diagnosed as a borderline personality disorder, which meant that she had wide mood swings, you know, within the space of like days. And so when I went off to college, I was the youngest kid and I was the closest one to her. She really felt abandoned. And she would go through these swings where she would call me. And, you know, back then, I think we had phone machines, not voicemail. And she would leave a message on my machine, enraged at me for some abandonment. I hadn't called her enough, or, you know, and I was a nice Jewish son. I mean, believe me, I called her enough. And so that would be the first message, would be enraged. And then the next message would be like a little less enraged. And then the next message, maybe Saturday night, would be, where are you? I'm worried about you. Where are you? Why haven't you called me back? You know, kind of thing. And I never called her back when she was in these states because I knew I would just get more abuse. And then by Sunday evening, she would be crying and saying, I need to talk to you. I know I've been really bad. I am so sorry, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And one time I just kept the whole weekend worth of messages and I would replay them to myself to remind myself that that first enraged message, which used to make me terrified and also enraged back, that was going to evolve into something else. Mm. And we were going to have a good relationship after this and it was all going to be okay. So it speaks to that point of you don't need to get trapped in what's happening in the present if you can keep the perspective that the future is going to have many, many more present moments that are a lot more sanguine than this one. You know?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And again, that speaks to the process of labeling. So exactly. Instead of saying, oh my God, she's enraged at me and I'm enraged back, I'm going to call her and tell her not to do that anymore. You're able to say, okay, that was call number one. I've seen this 1,000 times.
Exactly.
I'll wait till call number four.
Exactly.
And so, and you're able to kind of put things in perspective. And I think, but the other thing about a self-awareness, particularly when it's rooted out of, when your anxieties and are being rooted out of previous trauma, is that you're not, there are blind spots to trauma. You don't always recognize that you're traumatized and this is why you might be feeling anxiety about something.
Yes.
And I think part of these visualization techniques is to say, okay, I'm not going to know why, I'm not going to really make the direct link of why I'm feeling this anxiety, but here's what I could do right now to solve this problem.
Yes.
And I think that gets to, you know, before we get into the specific tools, which are all amazing and very useful, I kind of want to go through on Coming Alive. You sort of give a almost philosophical history of how you came up with this method of therapy and solving problems. And you start with kind of traditional therapy. I'll call it traditional therapy, but it, where, okay, you're angry at your kids because maybe you didn't receive enough love from your father, and recognizing that and working through your feelings about your father will help you better deal with your kids. And then you decided that was sometimes worked, sometimes didn't, but it wasn't that great a technique. What's your thoughts on that? And a lot of therapy is like, oh, you were treated this way when you were 12, so that's why this is happening.
Right. I feel, and Phil Stutz, my co-author, very much agrees with this, and I think, you know, really introduced me to this notion that traditional therapy works on a sort of causal continuum, if you want to use that word, meaning that the underlying assumption of traditional therapy is that if you can uncover the causes of your problems, that will solve your problems. And this always made me wonder, because I don't know how figuring out how I got this way changes how I am. I still am that way right now.
I guess you could say I'm just going to play devil's advocate. It could be a distancing technique. So for instance, if I feel a certain way about, let's say when I was 14, you know, every single girl I asked out rejected me, it could make me afraid to ask a girl out when I'm 50.
Absolutely.
Or a woman out when I'm 50.
Absolutely.
And so just recognize, like labeling.
And I'm not against understanding how you got the way you are now, but it feels to me like change happens in the present. In other words, no matter how well you understand how you got the way you are now, you have to do something different now. Mm. If I'm afraid to talk to girls, I can understand why I'm afraid to talk to girls and how that, you know, was caused by my past or whatever. But I still need a force, courage, that's going to get me to go up to a girl and talk to them. And what the tools are for is to bring up that force that you've never had access to before.
Right. So in this particular case, I'm just hypothetically saying, you, maybe it's a help, maybe it's a not, to understand where your current fears come from. But whether you understand it or not, using, let's say, the tool from Coming Alive called the Mother tool might help you get through that fear, regardless of whether you know the causes or not.
Exactly. Or the reversal of desire from the first book.
Describe that one again. I don't remember.
It's the tool where you take the fear that you're feeling and you push it out in front of you and give it the form of a dark cloud. And then you move through the dark cloud with these screaming declarations. Bring it on. I love fear, and fear sets me free. And you get this feeling of, you know, have you ever been really afraid to do something and something inside of you rises up and you just say, fuck it, I'm going to do it. That's the feeling that the reversal of desire creates inside of you. It's that feeling of, you know what, I'm fucking sick of being scared. I'm sick of being a coward. I'm going to do it. I'm going to go through it, you know, kind of thing. And what you discover with the reversal of desire is that fear is not absolute. It's relative to the direction that you're moving in. If you move toward fear over and over again in your life, you're less afraid.
Well, I like the analogy you use, which I relate to very much in the most recent book. I have a bad memory. Coming Alive, even though I just read it. I like the analogy you use where imagine a mugger with his gun at your head, and he says, "Give me all your money." And you, of course, give the mugger all your money. He's got a gun. And then often in life, that's not our choice to give the money. It's the mugger's choice. But often in life, we have these emotional guns to our head. Like, for instance, your mom calling you that first time, that's a gun to your head. You better call me or else I'm going to be even angrier. And so you feel like, oh my gosh, I should call my mom. And I think a lot of this is about, so many times, like, we go to a coffee, we go to a dinner, we placate our boss in a certain way, and it's not our choices, and people don't realize that adds up.
Yes.
That could be like, if you add it up all together, you lost 10 to 20 years of your life doing choices for other people.
Yes, and it reinforces something else, which is when you take action on a fear or on some other neurotic emotion, you actually reinforce that fear. You're, in a certain way, you're saying the fear is valid because I'm acting according to it. And the converse is also true. When you take action in spite of a fear, the fear gets less because you didn't die, you know? And in fact, usually nothing bad happens. I told you I'm afraid of public speaking. When every single time I've spoken publicly, afterwards, I feel elated. And I'm much more willing to do it the next time because nothing terrible happened, you know, kind of.
Actually, I want to continue first with the history aspect of, you know, how you kind of the intellectual genesis of where you came up with these techniques. Then you talk about cognitive behavioral therapy, which in general I like, which is, okay, you could sit there all you want talking about your mom and your dad and what happened when you were 5 years old, but at the end of the day, you have a problem, and this is the problem, and the therapist says, well, why don't you say this to your boss instead of that? And I kind of like the technique. And I'll tell you why I like it, because it's. I feel then you're using the therapist as a statistician.
Yes.
So I had this situation. I'm having this situation with, let's say, my boss or wife or whatever, and the therapist has seen this 10,000 times. So statistically, what's worked and what hasn't, and he or she is able to say, well, why don't you say this? Because it's almost like you're using the therapy, you're throwing a situation, they pattern match into their database of tens of thousands of situations because they have thousands of clients over the years, and they're able to tell you what is probably the best answer. So I kind of like cognitive behavioral therapy for that.
I do too, actually, and it's before I met Phil, that was basically what I practiced, and what I loved about it was, irrespective of your history and irrespective of insight into your history, they would give you very specific tools, things that you could do in the present, you know, like like the idea of labeling is a cognitive behavioral tool, essentially. It's just saying, I know there's a part of me that's really scared, but I don't have to be that part of me. I can exist separate from it. That's essentially a cognitive behavioral tool. Another cognitive behavioral tool is just simply facing your fears. You know, taking contrary action is a cognitive behavioral tool. When I know that I have an irrational fear of public speaking, so I want to do as much public speaking as I possibly can, and it will in fact dissolve my fears. The only thing that I felt was really missing from cognitive behavioral therapy was the idea of inner forces. So my story about that was that I grew up the youngest of a very hyper intellectual family. I mean, they were so bright. They still are. My sister is the brightest person I know. And I was always trying to catch up to you know, and I always felt stupid. Even after I went to Harvard College and law school.
You had to throw that in.
Yeah, sorry. I used to say, I don't hold it against me, but.
No, you passed 5 minutes, so that's success.
Thank you. But my point is, no matter how much I achieved, I always felt really stupid and kind of worthless inside. And labeling that never made it go away. What made it go away was these tools where I could actually tap into forces inside of me that enabled me to do things that I'd never done before. And seeing myself do those things made me feel really strong inside, made me feel like I am who I am. Yeah, they were extraordinarily bright and accomplished, but I am too, and I don't even really need to compare myself to them anymore. I'm my own person. I know I may not be describing it right, but it's rather than simply labeling this part of me, it's going beyond that and tapping into potential that I didn't know I had.
So a lot of these tools, though, these visualization tools, they remind me, they're kind of a, it's almost like you're saying, okay, I'm going to take versions of compassion-oriented meditation, and I'm going to westernize them. I'm going to call them a psychological tool, and I'm going to formulate them in different ways. So there's, you know, you have tools, the Black Sun, the Vortex, the Mother, the Tower. But a lot of it reminds me of just very much thinking about all the people around you in a very compassionate way, whether they've treated you that way or not, just kind of rewiring your brain to view them compassionately instead of falling in the patterns of stress and anger and hatred and whatever. And could you argue that that style of meditation could have helped you, for instance, on public speaking? I'm going to love the audience, and then I know when I go up there, I don't need to be as afraid. I'm loving them and trying to help them, and I don't need to be afraid.
Absolutely. Mostly because in loving the audience, I'm tapping into something inside of me, a sort of a givingness, in a sense, that defines me as having value. In fact, most of people's fear of public speaking is the feeling that you are defined by the audience, that it's really they who are going to put the thumbs up or the thumbs down, you know, like the Roman emperor, you know, condemning the gladiator. And when you can feel like you have something to give, and the whole point of your being there is to give them something, then it doesn't really matter whether they don't like you or don't like you. All you have to do is give the best that you have to give. And that sounds conceptual, but when you can really feel that inside of you, and I feel that when I'm speaking publicly, like there's wisdom or juice or compassion or love inside of me that I'm giving to other people, that really shifts the reality. It's kind of like they're either going to receive it or not, or do whatever they want with it, but I'm here to give it, you know, kind of thing. I think the moment a human being can feel like they have something to give, something inside of them, and they're going to give it out regardless of the response, they're automatically in a good place. I mean, I'm not an addict or an alcoholic, but I study 12-step groups because I think that they have a lot of wisdom in them. And they really encourage their members to be of service to one another, because what they find is that the more they give, the less they crave. They've reoriented themselves to the outside world so that they're giving more and craving less. And craving can be about a drug or alcohol, but it can also be about validation or, you know, being liked or anything else, or social media hits or, you know, whatever. It's putting yourself in a more powerful position when you say, I'm defined by what I give, not by what I get back.
So this makes me wonder, like, where we're all primates, and primates for 6 million years live in tribes, and the tribes are ranked from the alpha person to the omega person. And in tribes for millions of years outside of humans, tribes are only about 30 entities, you know, 30 apes or chimpanzees or whatever. Everybody knows their place in the hierarchy. You know exactly who is above you and who is below you in the hierarchy. And it's okay. You kind of deal with your place. And I find in this right now, we have this world where there's many hierarchies. Like, you might have an Amazon ranking or your number of Twitter followers or whether your wife and kids love you. Like, there's lots of different ways we look for validation. And like, I've had points where I've been obsessed, meaning I'll be happy if, let's say I write an article, I'll be happy if a lot of people read it, and I'll get really not only sad, but just disgusted with myself if not a lot of people read it or not a lot of people share it. And I found the best way for me was to kind of diversify hierarchies. So if one hierarchy wasn't working, I'd go into another one. I'd find, okay, well, this isn't working today for me, but maybe this other one is working for me today. Where does that fit in terms of, like, you know, conquering this need for validation? Because we do need validation. We can't help 6 million years of evolution.
Yeah. I mean, God, I have so many different responses to that. In order to be fully yourself, I think that you have to put the hierarchy aside, even though it's there, even though it's real. In other words,
it's almost impossible. Like, our brains are wired for hierarchy.
It is and it isn't. I mean, you mentioned the shadow earlier, and I find that the shadow is a very, very effective, just to back up for a moment, what the shadow is a different being living inside of you. I know that sounds weird and strange, but it consists of whatever it is you're most embarrassed of, self-conscious about, ashamed of, and also whatever you're guilty about, you know, things that you've done, things that you've wished you could have done, you know, wishing evil on other people, you know, whatever it is. It's a dark part of yourself. Now, obviously, it doesn't have a separate physical body. It's not like a head sticking out of your neck, but it does have a separate identity. It's sort of the opposite of you, you know, the you that you want to present publicly. Now, if you maintain the stance that most people maintain toward their shadow, which is, I'm ashamed of it, I feel guilty about it, I'm going to hide it as much as I possibly can from everyone else, then you are reinforcing the hierarchy in essence, because what you're saying is, God forbid they see my shadow. And really, whenever you present yourself, whether it's public speaking or just a dinner party or something, it really becomes more about hiding your shadow than about giving what you have to give to others. A great way to dissolve the hierarchy is to be so bonded with your shadow, and the book goes on and on about how to do that, be so bonded with your shadow that the two of you cannot be pitted against one another by any judgment that you receive from the outside world. It's almost like a way of negating the hierarchy, because we're in this together, so solid and so with each other that, like me or hate me, I don't really care.
I think that's because you're kind of separating, even though it's a part of you, all these fears and worries and need for validation, you're separating that out in your mind. You're visualizing this separate person. Yes. Like when I did it that one time before public speaking, I pictured kind of this sniveling teenage version of myself that was always really scared and whatever. And you separate that out. So that's the person that needs the validating, and I'm good to go.
Exactly.
And actually, that talk, I gave a great talk, and I felt super confident walking up to the stage. Like, it really worked. And I'll say the difference between that and, let's say, just a compassion meditation is that it's this very specific visualization dealing with that specific problem. So,
yes.
So there is gradation between, let's call it, no visualization and, you know, compassion meditation. Like these, I'll call them westernized type meditations, are for specific problems that we encounter often in daily lives.
Exactly. It's. I have nothing against meditation, and I do meditate. You know.
Well, these tools are often meditations.
They're meditative. Yeah, exactly. But the tools are designed to be used in a specific situation for a specific problem. You know, kind of thing. The other thing I wanted to mention, apropos what you just said, what was it? I'll tell you something else, which is that the shadow, once it is integrated and bonded with, rather than being a source of shame, becomes a resource. So I cannot count the number of times in therapy sessions. This is a dirty little secret that most therapists won't tell you, which is over and over again in a therapy session, you know, you'll be nodding thoughtfully and thinking inside, I don't know what the fuck to say. I have this problem too. What am I going to say to this guy? When that happens to me, and it really happens often, even though I'm a good therapist, I turn to my shadow and say, what do I do? What do I say here? And I can't tell you how many times he has started talking through me.
What's an example?
I'll give you a strange example. This was a long time ago, maybe 15, 20 years ago. I was treating this very kind of, I don't mean this in a critical way, he just was kind of dull. He was like an accountant type, and he was sort of droning on and on about kind of superficial problems. I was almost like wondering, why are you in therapy? You know, kind of thing. These are like sort of mundane things that you could talk to your friends about or something. And so I turned to my shadow and I said, what's going on here? Like, what, I'm getting bored. And he said, look at his eyes. And so I just focused on his eyes, and I saw in my mind's eye a tear running down his cheek. It was in my mind's eye. It wasn't a hallucination, but I stopped him and I said, you know, I'm listening to what you're saying, but the feeling I'm getting inside is that you are really sad, just really sad inside. And the guy took a beat and burst into tears. And that's when the therapy started. It was like he was just droning on and on as a way of just hiding from himself, I think, more than me, just how desperate and unhappy he was. So that would be an example of how the shadow has become a resource. The other thing is I tend to be kind of like a nice person. And so when I feel like a session isn't really like truthful and deep, I'll turn to the shadow and he'll say, be honest, this person is really lame in this area, you know, like just tell them they're fucked up, you know, kind of thing. Be more honest.
And like, what's the situation there?
Let's just say, I'm going to disguise this a little bit, but a very, very accomplished actress, Academy Award winner, unbelievable ability to get into shockingly different characters, you know, like truly a craftsman when it comes to acting and dramatic, you know, personification. And yet in her relationship, she's a fucking disaster, you know? Doesn't know how to set limits, doesn't know how to say no, lets herself be abused, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Can you introduce me to Halle Berry? Is that like?
Could be any number of. And, you know, you need to tell them that. You need to tell them the truth. You need to tell them, look, you're beautiful. You're wonderful. You are incredibly talented. I would watch you on in any movie or any TV show you've ever been on. But let's just face facts. You're a fucking moron when it comes to relationships, and I'm going to teach you how to set limits so that you can have a decent relationship with a guy. You know, kind of thing.
Where do you think she would sabotage herself?
Well, first of all, I mean, it starts at the beginning, dating guys who have horrible reputations, you know, and at least in Hollywood, there's usually some truth to the reputations. It's not just, you know, bullshit. It's like, yeah, if that much has come out, you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg, you know? So it's also like, you don't, look, let me put it this way. There are certain fundamental parameters that you try to teach people about relationships. I was about to say women, but it's true for men also. Number one, you want someone who can talk honestly about their drawbacks, about their problems, but not only be honest about them, tell you how they're working on them specifically. Like if somebody can't do that or won't do that, I'm not saying on the first date necessarily, but you know, at least once you feel like there's something substantial there, that's not a good sign. It's just not a good sign.
What if they think they're working on it, but you feel they're not?
That's the second parameter, which is watch, monitor, see in those situations where you feel like they should be doing something different, are they actually trying to do something different? Or are they at least coming to you afterwards and saying, you know, that was one of those leverage points where I should have done something different and I didn't. And I just want you to be aware I'm working on this, you know, kind of thing. Another is empathy. It's amazing to me how few people consider empathy a fundamental requirement for the person they're in a relationship with. If you're speaking to someone about a difficulty that you have or about some pain that you have, and they're like, I'm not interested, you know, whatever. And that's a pattern. It's not just like a one-time thing. That's a very bad sign. Like, why would you want to spend your life with someone like that? You know, kind of thing. So there are fundamental parameters that for whatever reason, these people didn't pick up, you know, maybe they didn't see it in their parents' marriage or whatever. And usually it's because they don't actually feel entitled to those things. You know, entitlement gets a bad rap in Hollywood because people are so over-entitled. But in relationships, women especially in Hollywood don't feel entitled. They don't feel entitled to attention. They don't feel entitled to empathy. They don't feel entitled to certain basic things like, I don't get hit. I don't get, you know, sexually harassed. I don't get abused, you know. It's shocking to me, and not just in Hollywood, but of all of the women that I've treated throughout my career, I would say that 80% of them have been sexually harassed, sexually abused, or molested by members of their family.
And how does someone like that, that's such a traumatic thing, how do they really get over it? Because, you know, they're going to be in intimate relationships with men. So there's two things that can go wrong. They end up, and this applies in both directions really, but they could end up with somebody who's like the person who treated them poorly because that's what they're used to. And they're trying to get validation from the prior person. So they go out with someone similar. Or if they are with someone who's a decent person, they can't get over the trauma enough to really have a regular relationship with them. I don't know what regular means there, but, you know, roughly.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I mean, that the answer is probably hours long, but to summarize it quickly, number one, make sure that you're not continuing the pattern, because every single time you forge a relationship with another abuser, you're reinforcing that trauma. You know, it's, you're letting it happen again.
Right, so that now you're going to the second situation where you succeeded in finding someone who's a decent person, you're in a relationship with them, but still all these past traumas trigger so many different things.
And that, I mean, I hate to be one note about this, but that has to do with the shadow. So the shadow of a traumatized person feels betrayed, not just by the traumatizer, but by you, because you let it happen. So especially if you were an adult when it happened, you didn't set proper limits. And so the shadow needs to be reassured, number one, that I will not let that happen again. Number two, I will be sensitive to your fears and move forward at a pace that you're comfortable with. And if the guy doesn't like it, fuck him. Tough. I'm damaged, and my job is to protect you from further damage. So I'm not, and again, this goes back to the public speaking thing. I'm not going to care more about the other person's sexual gratification or whatever it is than I care about you. You're a part of me. You're my first loyalty. You're my primary charge, you know, in a sense. And then number three, as things begin to develop, and I've seen this over and over again, you're going to find reasons to sabotage this. And they're going to be all kinds of reasons, depending on who you are. You know, they may be, it's interesting that women who have been abused often become hypercritical of men who don't abuse them. You know, ugh, I don't like the way his breath smells, or ugh, I don't like the way he chews, or whatever. And it's all just a way of getting out of real intimacy, you know, because that's what real intimacy is. You're not only going to experience your own shadow, you're going to experience the other person's shadow. Wow. You know, what a trip that is.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, Of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was four plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And
the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails, like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.
Given that you're saying 80% of the women, or up to 80% of the women you've treated have experienced this, and this is just a specific situation. There's men have experienced their things, women have experienced their things. How would you advise the men who are going out with one of these 80%? Because then most men are going out with or married to a woman who has had some kind of trauma.
Yeah.
And might not understand the pacing, or might understand the forms of sabotage or whatever. Yeah. So yeah. I see what you're saying, like, you know, screw them if they're not fine with your pacing, but men can be confused too.
Yeah, and look, men have to kind of answer a threshold question, which is, am I up for this? Because it's work to be, you know. I mean, look, I haven't been abused, and my wife hasn't been abused, and it's work anyway. I mean, relationships are hard. Relationships, to me, are the hardest thing anybody will ever do in their life.
Why is that? Like, you would think two people meet, oh, I love you, I love you. Like, you would, they're okay, live happily ever after. But that doesn't really happen.
No.
In fact, actually, it gets really bad after that.
It gets really bad after that, yeah.
And not bad in a sense that, oh, there's betrayal and beating and all that, but just like the emotional maze that you go through when you're trying to entangle your life with somebody is very difficult.
Because, I mean, I think that there is no situation in life where you are as nakedly vulnerable to another human being as a relationship. It's scary to start a business. Don't get me wrong. It's scary to go to war, you know, or be a soldier, you know, whatever. There are certainly really legitimately frightening experiences. But to live with someone, wake up next to them, go to sleep with them every single day, to have children with them, that is more revealing than anything else you will ever do in your life. And so to sustain, so you're going to see parts of the other person that you really didn't want to see, and they're going to see parts of you that you didn't really want anyone to see. And that's very, very difficult. Most people go into relationships thinking, just like what you said, it's going to be love, this is going to be great, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But they forget that vulnerability is gonna result in you feeling injured from time to time. The other person is gonna feel injured. You're gonna feel like, well, I didn't injure you intentionally, so get over it, you know, kind of thing. Then they're gonna feel even more injured because you're telling them to get over it, you know. And that's why, you know, so much of my work is about relationships, whether they're business or, you know, more often personal, is because it's really difficult to sustain love, you know, through that. In a sense, it goes back to the earlier discussion we had about love, compassion, and outflow. Relationships are the arena where that is absolutely the most important thing. Because if you can't be in an outflow, loving, compassionate, trying to understand the other person, even when every fiber of your being says, fuck this, you know, I hate this, I don't want to do this, or I'm hurt, or he's wrong, or she's wrong, or whatever, that's what makes relationships work.
So in Coming Alive, you know, you give 4 tools for dealing with various different problems, and given how the importance of relationships, which tool would you recommend in general? Like, oh, I seem to be miscommunicating
with my loved one. And you know, at that point, by the time someone's saying that, they're probably not that rational. They're probably either angry or scared, or like you said, feeling injured or feeling sad or feeling lonely. So first they've got to label that this is how they feel and that they need some help instead of kind of ruminating over the actions of the other person over and over again. So what tool would you recommend from Coming Alive?
It's a great question. Unequivocally, the mother tool would be the one that I would recommend.
I was going to say that as well. If you did not say that, I was going to say that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because do you know why you were going to say that?
Yes, because I've used it, which is if I'm seeing somebody and there's some problem and I find myself ruminating, well, why did this person say this or that person? If I do it slightly different than you recommend in the book, but it works out to be the same thing, I visualize that I'm their mother. And then I have a whole, then suddenly the lens of which I'm looking at them is a whole different type of care and, you know, kindness than if I was, you know, their partner.
Yes.
Their romantic partner.
Yes. I think that's really insightful. If you want to say it another way, it's what I feel is that it's best to think of all relationships as actually having three members. So instead of being a dyad, it's actually a triad, a triangle. And the member at the top is the mother. Now, the mother, just for people who haven't read the book, doesn't mean your biological mother or your parent or any human being. It really is what Jung called an archetype, which is the quintessence of mother energy, which, you know, could simply be said as unconditional love, unconditional safety, and confidence in your potential, regardless of what you think of yourself. Now, think of it, if you can tap into some energy that loves you, wants to keep you strong and safe and believes in you no matter what's happening in the world, then you can deal with injuries much more easily. You can deal with misunderstandings more easily. If you can really feel that, you know, and that's what the tool is for. But if you can really feel that every moment of every day, then when my wife's in a bad mood or when she's accusing me of something I don't think I did or when I'm angry at her or whatever, I can calm down at least and communicate it in a simpler way. If you want to say it the other way around, because we live in a time in human history where we are ultimately materialists, meaning that we think of the material outside world as the hegemonous world, like that's what where everything counts and everything matters, we look to each other for that kind of love. And there's no way we can give it to each other. We're all just imperfect human beings. If I look to my wife for the kind of love that I should be looking to the archetypal mother for, forget it. There's just no way. She's too busy, hassled, worried about her own shit. I'm just not going to get it. But if I can feel that as a real thing being received from someone else, then I can approach her. And weirdly enough, I relieve her of the need to love me that way. And when she's relieved, she loves me more.
Yeah, well, I think also it makes you less outcome oriented.
Yes.
So instead of thinking in your head, I don't know what a problem might be, but like, you know, why didn't she wanna go to the place I wanted to go to? She only wanted to go to the place she wanted to go to and she knew I would have, blah, 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 blah. You could think you're not as much oriented on the specific outcome that did or didn't happen or won't happen, but you're thinking of in terms of like, oh, this is, you know, if you love someone like this archetypal mother, it's about loving right now as opposed to like being very focused on an outcome.
It's a great example. In my case, you know, I came out of this slightly crazy family, a control freak. I'm already pretty obsessive. Like when I walk into a room in our house, without even having to work at it, I automatically know what's out of place, you know, kind of thing. I no longer feel compelled to put it in, you know, back in place. But you could, and I married somebody who's not really, she's not a mess, but she's not really cares that much. And I used to like really get down on her. It was terrible, you know, kind of thing. It's just not who she is. Once I started to feel the love of the mother, it just gave me this feeling of, it's okay. Like, it's all right. Let her be. It's, you know, she doesn't need to to be as controlling as you. She doesn't have to be as obsessive as you are. You can just love her. And I became much more giving, and we got along much better, you know, kind of thing. So you're right. The mother relieves you of needing to control outcomes. And that's also true outside of relationships. You know, when a project that you're engaged in and that you've given your heart to doesn't succeed, it's the mother energy that picks you up and dusts you off and allows you to get, you know, back on track again. You know, if you think about it, that's a really good example, because that's exactly what a human mother does to a child when he's learning how to walk for the first time. You know, kids just fall down over and over, and it's the mother that picks them. It's the mother energy, whether it's coming through the father or the mother, that says, it's okay, I'm here, try it again, you'll do it again.
Well, and it's interesting, because when you're not outcome-oriented, the worst-case scenario can happen. Like, in a relationship, you can end up breaking up. It might not work out, but that's okay. We're not outcome-oriented. A job might not work out. The baby might fall over and over again while it's trying to walk. So you have to be ready for that, though, any outcome, really, even the worst-case outcome, whether that's a possibility or not. But I think, again, kind of doing that tool in the book helps you also able to deal with those worst case scenario outcomes, which you couldn't have avoided anyway.
Yes.
But you know, if two people are meant to break up, no matter how much loving kindness you apply, then they're going to break up.
Yes.
They're certainly not going to stay together if you get angry as opposed to, you know, being loving.
Totally.
So
can I bring up another area where it's very useful is parenting, because parents, I think, now are under more pressure than they've ever been under to produce perfect kids. And it's horrible. It's really horrible. And for me, at least, what enabled me, I think, not to give in to that trend was the archetypal mother. In essence, the archetypal mother allowed me to be an imperfect parent, because I knew I was, and there was no way I was going to be perfect, and to just simply love them for who they were, regardless of how they turned out. You know, parenting is one of those situations where the outcome, quote unquote, feels like it's so high stakes that it's almost impossible not to get invested in it. But you can't, because success means they're no longer doing it for you. They are full individuals in and of themselves. So the ultimate goal is to let go. It's not to take credit or to hold on, you know, to the thing. And it's only if you're getting the love and the sense of who you are from someplace else that you can actually allow that to happen.
It's funny, because I think it's very funny how every parent always finds something in their child that the child is the best at. Like, oh, my son just won his high school's archery competition, or, you know, he's straight A honor roll student, and I'm so proud. So, you know, we're filming this podcast in a stand-up comedy club. I often do stand-up comedy downstairs, and I have a joke that works most of the time, which is that it starts off basically saying, my kids are at best, on a scale of 0 to 10, a 3 or a 4.
That's
whether
great.
It's looks or intelligence or charm or creativity, 4 tops. And people like, Campbell, what did he say? Like, exactly. And then they start laughing after the first gasp, and then I go off from there. But
that's,
it works.
Hilarious. You know, my daughter actually taught me my philosophy of parenting. She's a stand-up comic in LA.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in LA. And she wrote me this Father's Day card about 5 years ago that started, Dear Dad, Happy Father's Day. I love you. Thank you for fucking me up enough to be a stand-up comic, but not enough to be a stripper. Which to me is my whole
that
philosophy.
That is funny.
It's like, you're going to fuck up your kids. Just try not to go too far, you know, kind of thing.
That's great.
I have told that to so many parents, and it's such a relief for them to hear, because it's kind of like, yeah, you know, you're not going to be able to not pass on some of the shit that you have. You just don't want to go too far, you know, kind of thing.
So, you know, a lot of the things that I like, you start off the book talking about, you know, how we can best bring to life the living force that's inside of us. And from a marketing point of view, I love it because it makes me think of the Force in Star Wars. And it makes me think of like, oh, if I apply these tools, there's like infinite power at my disposal. And what would you say, are the techniques, or what's the technique that you like the best of the four that really does let you feel the Force? So that's again a naive question, but
it's a great question.
I do
question.
Like the way the book started off, focusing so much on like we have this like active living force inside of us.
Yeah.
And I love Star Wars.
Yeah. I mean, the truthful answer is there are other tools that I use to feel that force even more than the four that are in the book. But the Black Sun, which is in the book, is probably the tool that I use the most. It's a tool that's designed, to restrain your impulses, whether you have, and we all have impulses, whether it's alcohol or cigarettes or
anger,
exactly. Your impulses can be reactive. You know, in LA, it's like flipping people off in traffic. And whatever impulses you have are a kind of a discharge of the life force. They leave you needing more, essentially. In other words, the more you give into impulses, the more you want to give into them, in a sense. Impulses are, it's not for nothing that they used to be seen as the tool of the devil, because they're this funny thing where the more you gratify an impulse, the stronger the impulse is the next time. It's not like you actually are satisfied. You know, like I love sugar cookies. I can't just have one and then be satisfied. I want one tomorrow and the next day and the next day. Whereas the more you restrain your impulses, the more the impulse energy sort of transmutes itself inside of you and you become very, very powerful. The force becomes with you, to use, you know, the Star Wars terminology, instead of against you. And that's called dynamic inversion in the book. It's just literally over and over again, if you can restrain the impulse, and the Black Sun tool is designed to help you restrain it at the moment you're experiencing it, it builds up and builds up and builds up inside of you so that you have more to give, more energy, more life force, and more ambition, frankly. It's one of the reasons, again, I mentioned 12-step groups. If you study people in their first year of sobriety, they almost always experience a renaissance. You know, their relationships get better. They finally start doing all of the projects that they were interested, you know, in doing. I treated a guy who was a longtime addict, and the first year of sobriety, he won an Oscar-winning screenplay. It was just bang. He was just, you know, there. And it's proof that this transmutation can occur, you know, inside of you. So whenever I get an impulse, I mean, mine are tend to be mild, you know, it's like I'm like a Jewish guy. I don't really indulge that much. But when I get the impulse and I can transmute it, it's a tremendous feeling.
You know, so maybe describe that, the Black Sun technique.
Yeah, sure. So the Black Sun is based on the idea that you wouldn't feel impelled to get something outside of you, again, whether it's a drink or a cookie or another donut or whatever, you wouldn't feel impelled to get it if you weren't missing something inside, right? It would be more take it or leave it. It'd be more like a choice. And most people try to control that urge through sheer willpower. And some can succeed, which is fine. The problem is, whether you succeed or fail, you've still left this empty hole inside of you, which is why in 12-step groups, they call people who do this stuff by sheer willpower dry drunks. And they tend to be really angry people because they live in a state of constant deprivation. I want a drink, I want a drink, I want a drink, but I'm not going to let myself have it, you know, kind of thing. And they're pissed off at life because they can't gratify themselves. So what would happen if, instead of doing it by sheer willpower, you actually stopped thinking about the thing that you want altogether, and in fact let go of the entire outside world as a source that's ever really going to gratify you, and instead just stare at the empty hole inside of you? Now, that sounds strange. But if you can, what the tool teaches you to do is simply to look inside, stare at this abyss, this empty place inside of you, and then gradually visualize a dark sun, just exactly like the sun looks like at the moment of a total solar eclipse, rising inside of you. And the black sun, it symbolizes an infinite resource that's inside of your unconscious that you've always buried by going to the outside world for gratification. And as it rises inside of you, it just fills you with warmth and strength and givingness. It fills you up inside. And then at the very end of the tool, you look back to the outside world, but instead of wanting to extract something from it, you give this black sun energy to it. And that, again, codifies that principle that I mentioned earlier, which is the solution to our endless craving to get more from the outside world is actually to give more to the world. And it works. It's really remarkably effective. It sounds more complicated than it is. If you read the book, you'll see it's like basically four steps. But if you do it over and over and over again, when you have the impulse to rage, or you have the impulse to react to somebody, the impulse to get something that you know just isn't good for you, it becomes almost like second nature. And it's an enormous relief, because it's like, not only do I not actually need that thing, suddenly I feel like I'm in a state where I can give more, you know, like I have more to give to others. Which goes back to what you said in the beginning, which is basically the more love and compassion you can give out to the world, the stronger you are. In a weird way, it's an unselfish, it appears unselfish, but in a healthy way, it's actually the most selfish thing you can do inside, because it shifts your whole state of mind.
Well, I mean, and this gets back to the mugger analogy. You know, the mugger has the gun to your head, so you have to give your money. That's not your choice. But all day long, you know, people emotionally have guns to our heads, and we're constantly doing things that's not our choice, but we're trying to satisfy their choices so they're not upset at us. And just think how much of your life you could grab back. It seems selfish to only to say, oh no, I'm only going to do it if it's my choice. Like, on the one hand, that does seem selfish. I mean, I wrote a book called Choose Yourself, and the initial criticism I got was, oh, that seems very selfish all the time. But actually, if you're not choosing yourself, then when do you get to live the life you want?
Yes.
And that should be the best for the world.
Yes, exactly. Which goes back to the discussion about traditional therapy. I do find traditional therapy sometimes can become self-indulgent when all it consists of is talking about how my parents damaged me, you know, kind of thing. But it's the opposite of self-indulgent to work on yourself in an effective way and become more productive, more loving, more giving in the world. That's wonderful. That's the opposite of self-indulgence.
So what are what's a technique not in the book that you find yourself often using?
I, for some reason, really find cosmic rage one of the most effective tools for me personally. Now, this also goes back to something earlier that we were talking about that had to do with somebody criticizing you or somebody oppressing you in some way. I learned very early to try to think of, let me start over. Everybody has someone in their life, whether it's their mother, in my case, their spouse, a friend, whatever, who's just difficult. They're just difficult, okay? And I believe that that person is in your life, in a sense, to get you to work on yourself and discover potential that you never had before, because you're never really going to be able to make the relationship work. It's one of those sort of impossible, you know, things. And the first step to that is, don't think of it as the person. Think of it as, I'm meeting a force that exists in the outside world that hates me, is critical of me, is just unequivocally difficult. And I'm going to meet it in other people, by the way, from time to time. My job is to learn to fend off that force, not to make the relationship work with this person. Is that clear?
Yeah.
So I'm lifting it up a little bit above the level of the personal to a more archetypal level. everyone has to deal with someone difficult, somebody who's bad or evil, you know, in their lives. And I would rather teach them how to deal with the force of evil, because then they can apply it to anyone who's difficult. Even a three-year-old can be evil, you know, in their life. And if they can deal with the force rather than trying to get along with the person, then they can evolve and become much more powerful and much more confident, frankly, in life.
So what's the exact mental process like when you're dealing with?
So let's say my mother's dead, but let's say she was alive and she calls me and she starts ranting and raving at me. What I immediately do is I see my mother, but I see her surrounded by a dark, malicious force that is trying to undermine my confidence in myself. It's trying to get me to be anxious and scared and insecure and feel attacked. And, you know, this could work just as well with a mean boss or, you know, something like that. And I make her smaller and smaller and smaller. So she disappears. So all of a sudden I'm just facing this dark, malicious force. And I remind myself, this force has attacked me my entire life and it has turned me against myself. And what I need is a counterforce with which to push the dark force back. And that counterforce is rage. If you think of rage, it is, number one, our normal human reaction to unfairness.
But here, I guess you're aiming the rage not at your mother.
Not at all.
But at this dark cloud that's...
Exactly. And all the rage does is it doesn't get rid of the force, but it pushes it back beyond a perimeter so that there's space in front of me. Now, space is a very important concept for a human being. When we talk about space, we're not talking about physical space. We're talking about the psychic space where you can be confident, where you can be yourself regardless of what's going on in the outside world. That's what space really is. When you can push evil back beyond that perimeter and feel this space opening up in front of you, you can feel like, I am who I am. I'm strong. I don't really give a flying fuck about the way you're treating me or what you think of me or anything else. And that, to me, is a very powerful tool. The reason it's rage, and, you know, people often have a problem with rage because what they've experienced is rage directed at another human being. And I just want to make it clear, I'm never saying rage against another human being. But rage is the best force to use against a force that's trying to undermine your confidence, that's trying to make you, turn you against yourself or make you feel insecure. Because it's A, your natural human reaction, and B, it's a force that tends to repel things. You know, love attracts, it brings things closer to you. Rage pushes things away from you. I learned this actually from stand-up comics who I treated, who told me that before they got on stage, they would feel really, really nervous and they would really want the audience to like them. And what they would do is stand behind the closed curtain before it opened up and they would say, fuck you, to the audience as loud as they could as a way of saying, I don't give a shit. I'm just going to give you what I give. That's it, you know, kind of thing. And it liberated them. And I realized, holy shit, that's great. That's a tool.
That's interesting. That's sort of the opposite of, let's say, going up for public speaking and loving the audience.
Right.
So, but right. They both kind of have the same.
And they both work because you're activating forces inside of you. You know, because that's the whole thing is, it doesn't matter which, it's like whatever works is my motto of therapy. But what's key is that you feel something coming up inside of you to counteract our normal human tendency, which is to derive our worth and value from the outside. Whether it's love and you're pouring love out to them or whether it's rage and it's like, fuck you, I don't give a shit what you think of me. Either way, you're defining yourself as a whole, separate human being who's got something to say.
Well, I don't know if you realize this, but this entire podcast has been a therapy session for me. how much money do I owe you? Are you
nothing.
$600 an hour? if you work in New York City, you're $600 an hour. Right. I could tell you from experience. But... thank you so much for coming in. I feel like we've been trying to have a podcast for years because I loved the tools back in the day.
Right.
And then this book, Coming Alive, I got it as soon as it came out and it's just great. I've read it twice over now when it first came out and then more recently. So Coming Alive by Barry Michaels and Phil Stutz, and The Tools, also by the same authors. I really encourage people to read both of them because they kind of work hand in hand, and they're just incredibly useful. Whether you use the tools or not, your discussion, and I do recommend using them. I've used them, but the tools you describe, but I just find the whole discussion of all these different types of common problems that people have, it's very interesting. It's very useful to learn and see and understand. So thanks once again, Barry, for coming in, and I hope you write the next book.
Thanks.
Cosmic Rage, chapter number one.
Yeah, I've got to write a book on that. Thank you so much. I really, really appreciate it. And I love your enthusiasm, and I love listening to your podcast, too.
Oh, great. Thank you.
You did a podcast with one comedian where you analyzed a joke that he tells.
Oh, yeah, it Gary Goldman.
Greatest. I love that.
Yeah, we took a 5-minute joke or a 6-minute joke that he had done on Conan, and I thought it was such a brilliant joke. And we spent basically 90 minutes breaking it down word by word.
I've never seen that done. And it was so like edifying. It was so illuminating. It was amazing.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, that was a good one. Yeah. So thanks once again, Barry. And the book is Coming Alive, 4 Tools to Defeat Your Inner Enemy, Ignite Creative Expression, and Unleash Your Soul's Potential. And of course, if you enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcast to the James Altucher Show. And I would really appreciate it if you did, because that helps me, helps you, hopefully helps everyone. And thanks again for listening.
Sometimes it takes a different approach to help you unlock your true potential. With Capella University's game-changing FlexPath learning format, you gain relevant skills you can apply to your career right away. Earn your degree from an accredited university and be confident in the quality of your education. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu. Capella University is accredited by the Higher Learning Commission. Learn more at capella.edu/accreditation.